Fred Pearce has made a name for himself as an environmental journalist who gets right under the skin of an issue. He's written a number of best-selling books about the very big issues of the day, notably When the Rivers Run Dry, a very sobering assessment of the alarming depletion of freshwater supplies in many, if not most, parts of the world, and his analysis of the so-called Climategate affair a year or so ago, when several climate scientists in Britain were accused of fiddling the numbers in order to reinforce their evidence of global warming. That book, Climate Files, sets out to put this rumpus into perspective in the wider climate change context. Fred Pearce is currently in New Zealand as a guest speaker at the Climate Futures Conference, organised by Victoria University's Climate Change Research Institute. I asked him, when you look at the overall international response on climate change and the level of disputation about its reality, do you get a bit discouraged?
I'm discouraged because we have so far to go and we seem to have taken only the first faltering steps. But, you know, when I was first working as a journalist on these issues, nobody had heard of climate change. And we've come a long way. Everybody has now heard of climate change, even if they don't always believe in it. So I'm kind of optimistic about the extent to which we've all got our heads around this idea. I'm also optimistic because we do have the technologies to get away from this carbon-based. I mean, the problem is we burn all these carbon fuels, coal and oil, and we put the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that's warming us. We've got to get away from those carbon fuels. We could do it with nuclear power. I have no objection to nuclear power. We can do it with renewables, but we've got to find a way of doing it. We know how to do it, and it's actually not too expensive. Am I confident about our political ability to go ahead and do it? Well, that's a harder one. Not sure.
It seems to me that the scientists have been thrust out front all the time. And in some respects, they ought to be, because this is their findings on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. They blew the whistle, for sure.
But there doesn't seem to be much backing for them. I mean, the scientists are often left stranded, and this whole issue of climate gate, which you've written about, is a demonstration of that. I mean, have the scientists had a bad rap here? And should they now stand back somewhat? The data is there. There's enough data, one assumes, to take action. And leave it to the policymakers, who are not out front as much as they should be.
I think the scientists have had ownership of this probably as long as they need. They've done the real good heavy lifting research. They've done some heroic work working out exactly what the likely effects of climate change is. They've got probably as far as they can. From now on, you know, the detail of exactly what the weather's going to be like in Wellington in 2040, nobody really is going to know. And we need to, as a society, get used to the idea that we're not going to have real detail. We've just got to recognize that the climate is going to change. Find ways of halting that change. We can't halt it all, but we can stop it somewhere down the track. And find ways of living with the change that we can't stop. And that's a thing for society to do. It's not really about scientists anymore. Yeah. So when I talk to scientists, they don't like it, but when I talk to scientists, I say, actually, you guys, you've got to hand over this story. It's got to stop being a science story. It's got to be about government. It's got to be about economics. It's got to be about our culture, the way we live. The most important report on climate in the last 5 years was not from IPCC, the guys at the UN. It was from Lord Stern, the British economist from the World Bank, who wrote a report on the economics of climate change. And that's the one that is driving the agenda now. Yeah. So it's not about the climatology. It's about how society deals with what the scientists have found out.
Have we got past the climate gate fallout?
I don't think we have. I mean, it's not in the headlines anymore, of course, but I think there is an undertow of increasing public skepticism about exactly what the scientists know and what they don't know, which is a shame because the basic story is very clear. It's 200-year-old physics. We know about these gases that are heating the atmosphere. We know why they heat the atmosphere. They trap the sun's heat. We know they're accumulating in the atmosphere because we're burning all the coal and oil and putting the carbon dioxide up there. So we know we're going to have this warming effect. As I say, the detail we don't know, but the big stuff we know about. And it's a shame that that's got rather lost in discussion about detailed misdemeanors, if you like, by some of the climate scientists who are really probably doing not much more than trying to hang on to their data and keep control of the debate. That's perhaps another reason why I think scientists need to let go. They begin to, when they start engaging in fractious disputes about small areas of the science, they begin to become part of the problem rather than the solution.
Yes, and of course that material is then writ large through the media. Do the fact that the relative failure at the international global level in Copenhagen and the fallout from that in terms of we can't seem to do anything internationally, did that provide a number of governments with comfort in the sense that, we can slow down a little here, we can shelve some of the policy measures that were being proposed? Or does it mean that governments are now realizing that they must act nationally rather more vigorously? Is it a bit of both?
Possibly both, actually. Yeah. I think there is a sense now that with the US not in a position, even if Obama wants to deliver firm commitments on carbon emissions, other countries, and Russia and Japan in particular, are saying, well, if they're not, we're not. I'm not sure. New Zealand seems to be kind of sitting on the fence here in favour of firm treaties, but not perhaps now, or certainly not if everybody else isn't in. So there's a kind of drawing back. So there are now fewer countries committed to firm targets than there were even a couple of years ago. And also, I think if you fail once, it's easier to fail again. So everybody went to Copenhagen and, you know, they really wanted a deal or so they said, and then they failed to get a deal. And the political roof didn't fall in on them. So once you failed once, it's kind of easier to put it on the back burner, forget about it a little bit. You can see that happening in the US. Obama doesn't really want to touch it anymore because he's going to fail. He knows he's going to fail in his internal politics. And a number of other countries are a bit like that. But I don't think that's the end of the story. I think there is a plan B out there.
Yeah.
An awful lot of corporations, an awful lot of local authorities, even US states, are very keen to do things about climate change. California is in the forefront of trying to do things in the US. So a lot of things are going to carry on regardless. The European communities carry on with its own targets. Emissions trading schemes, a lot of people think they can profit out of emissions trading schemes. So why would they want to abandon them? They think they can make money out of it. And I think increasingly corporations want to make money out of climate change, and the smart ones will be able to do it.
And in the end, it's going to be driven by this, if nothing else. Right.
It'll be driven by the climate. I mean, everybody is saying, well, the climate won't wait for the diplomats, and we are great likelihood we're going to see, some pretty nasty events which will galvanize everybody. But meanwhile, actually, I think quite a lot of things are going on. So you go to China, you go to Brazil. Now, they're not going to accept internationally binding targets on their emissions, but nationally they're working actually very hard. You go to Brazil, they're talking about how to go to low carbon agriculture. You talk to China, they're trying to work towards low carbon industry. Lots of things are happening.
Many of those countries are able to move rather more quickly, partly because there's a sort of policy lacuna and there aren't entrenched interests, not so much by way of entrenched interests, as to slow them down. And in some cases, the government can take a decision and everyone must get on with it.
I think in Brazil, there are some quite strong entrenched interests in the agriculture as well. Yeah. But there is more kind of dynamism in the economy. Yes. There are things changing faster. People are investing more in different things. So it's easier to sort of change direction in that environment, certainly.
There has been, it seems, extensive attempts to try to muddy the waters in terms of what the science has been. There are vested interests. There's a big debate about this. I spoke to Naomi Oreskes on this program and received a huge amount of feedback. She maintains that there is an orchestrated campaign by some scientists who seem to have popped up in other areas like tobacco and so on, and has documented that. I got a lot of feedback from people saying, hey, how can you possibly allow this to happen? This is playing the man and not the ball. This is attacking the integrity of scientists. And it's really hard to respond because, unless you doubt her sources and the integrity of the stuff that's there, are these attempts to muddy the water on what action is necessary, if any, are going to continue to slow the whole process down?
It's a good question how much they'll slow the process down. There are certainly people with that agenda. And that for different reasons. Some of them are, if you like, free market ideologues, one might say, and they genuinely believe that if there's a climate problem, the free market is the best way of solving it, and we don't need international agreements. They will just stop us getting rich enough to find the money to solve the problem. That will be their approach. I understand it's not self-evidently wrong, that approach. There are some people who are more kind of duplicitous, who are just trying to find ways of helping their masters, perhaps in the fossil fuel industry or elsewhere. So there are the people with a range of motives, and undoubtedly they talk amongst each other, and undoubtedly they conspire, and undoubtedly there are dirty tricks that are going on. But I don't think you can say that therefore there is nothing to discuss in the science, or that the science is all sorted, or indeed that the policy prescriptions are all sorted. There are huge areas of debate. That denial industry, if you like, which does exist, finds, if you like, fertile soil in which to plant its seed when there is an undertow of kind of skepticism about climate change. And I think there is increasing skepticism. It's not dominant yet, but there's increasing skepticism about climate change for a range of reasons. Some of them have to do with ClimateGate. The failure of the Copenhagen conference has kind of opened that area up. People get a bit bored with this issue. It seems to come back and back and back and never gets solved. And I think, well, you know, isn't there something else we can talk about?
Yeah.
And then the economic problems of the last 3 years mean that people have got other things to worry about. All those, I think, are reasons why, if you like, climate scientists feel that they're losing ground in the arguments that they're making. But at the end of the day, the climate's going to come back and bite us. We're going to have to tackle this one. There's no way out of it.
Are we now in an age where adaptation is really the name of the game rather more than mitigation? I mean, it's a zero-sum game, isn't it? We're losing the battle on mitigating climate change effects. Now we're switching to dealing with them. I mean, is this a continuum?
It is a continuum. I mean, certainly we're going to have to adapt to climate change. There are time lags in the whole climate system. You know, the scientists will tell you, so the 20 or 30 years of climate change is already in the pipeline coming down. Nothing we can do about it. So we're going to have to adapt, and it will take time to change our energy systems. You know, that's not an easy thing to do.
No.
So we're going to be facing quite a lot of climate change. But that doesn't mean because we're adapting, that doesn't mean that we don't ultimately have to do something about those emissions. Because climate change isn't an on-off switch. It's not as if we have climate change or not. The longer we put those emissions out there, they accumulate in the atmosphere. They don't go away. They stay there and they build up more and more every year. The planet will warm more and more every year. At some point, we really do have to shut down those carbon emissions. The real question is how soon we can do it and how much damage we've done before we do it.
Mm.
So they both have to go together for sure now. We've got to adapt, but we've got to stop it too.
Is there still a head of steam behind the so-called geotechnical solutions?
Oh, increasingly. A lot more people are talking about it. I think many climate scientists who 5 years ago wouldn't have wanted to talk about geoengineering solutions are talking. They say, look, we can see how the political system is failing us in the short term at any rate to come up with solutions. If, as some scientists say, there may be kind of tipping points, really dangerous thresholds in climate change, you might get into kind of runaway climate change scenario. Now, they're not saying for sure they're there, but if science discovers those, we might need a fix very quickly. So what they say is we've really got to do the research so that if we do really need to shut something down very fast using a draconian, you know, parasols in space or filling the atmosphere with kind of tiny particles like a sort of mega volcano to cool things down in a really short term, we're ready to go. We know what to do. They don't want to do it, but I don't think anybody would say that's the preferred solution, but you know, we may one day be faced with that crisis.
It all sounds a little Dr. Strangelove-ish.
It is.
I mean, from what you say, these are being seriously considered.
Well, those are the stakes that the climate scientists say we're playing for, and I think they're right. We are, after all, pulling at exactly the same levers that nature pulls out when it pulls us in and out of ice ages. You know, except when we have a volcano or a big earthquake or something, we begin to get the idea that our planet is quite benign. But it is actually quite dynamic, and it can do things that are really very unpleasant for us. Now, of course, we can't stop earthquakes, but we should be careful about not triggering things unnecessarily. And there are certainly things that we can trigger in the climate system. If you look at that sort of overall, you know, we're living on a little green strip on the surface of a quite dynamic and unpredictable planet. We can't control everything, but let's, you know, control what we can, and that includes our own contribution to potential disasters down the road.
Now that would surely mean that the geotechnical solution, geoengineering solutions, are the most undesirable option of all.
Well, I think they are, but we might need right. them. You know, if push comes to shove, we might need to shove something in the pipe somewhere.
So countries have got to act. You've been fairly critical of New Zealand. You wrote a rather searing piece about New Zealand and greenwash. My prize for the most shameless two fingers to the global community goes to New Zealand, a country that sells itself around the world as clean and green. And you go on to give us a fair old serve. Is that fair? I mean, how bad does New Zealand look to you from the outside compared with other countries?
Well, it looks pretty bad, and it also looks somewhat hypocritical, I think. Hence, you know, you have the clean and green image, and you sell yourself quite, you know, as a kind of international brand on that for tourism, but also for agricultural products. You know, it's part of New Zealand's image. And yet, if you look at the numbers, the emissions coming out of New Zealand per head of population, I know you have a small population, but per head of population are 60% higher than those in the UK. You're right up there with Australia and the US, and that's not quite congruent with the clean and green image. And I know there are people within the government. I talked to Nick Smith a couple of days ago, and I know he is interested in these issues and keen to act on these issues, but equally there are other people, not just in the government, but within society in New Zealand, who really just want to let things roll, and especially those troublesome methane emissions coming out of the backs of the cows.
Yeah.
You know, there are some particular features of New Zealand emissions, which are certainly very different from those in Britain. But I think you have to address them, and I think you have to address them sooner rather than later. Otherwise, your image is going to be damaged. That is not just bad for the environment of New Zealand, not just bad for the global environment. It's bad for New Zealand economics, perhaps in the quite short term.
Yes, I think there's a tendency not to have to face that. We don't
you
particularly
bet. Well,
like
we're
the
all
idea
of us trying to avoid facing
that.
Nasty things, but no. I think it's coming down the track, and I think a pragmatic government, pragmatic industry should be thinking about these things. You know, your international reputation is rightly to be prized, but you have to protect it.
Well, there are various arguments by way of mitigation. At least we have a carbon tax. We have joined up with this, in fact, inspired this Global Alliance research effort on animal emissions. We don't know what it's going to produce. We hope that there will be a scientific solution here. If there is, then, and I think a lot of hopes depend on that,
when
we can reduce our emissions by quite substantially,
that
should get us home alone.
Yes, as in the energy industry, there are lots of solutions out there. They just need to be adopted and fine-tuned and so on. I think that will prove to be true in agriculture too. You can change the feeding regime for animals. You can play around with the genes of the animals to help reduce their methane emissions. So that work has got to be done. The research has started. I suspect perhaps you need to invest rather more in that. And perhaps industry should be doing more as well as government. But that's a task that has to be undertaken. I think there are rich pickings, and I think if you do the research and come up with the answers, they could have international applicability.
Yeah. We've adopted the 50% reduction in emissions by 2050, the so-called 50-50 approach, which you said some time ago was even the United States can trump that.
Whether it can or not, it's certainly promised to. So 50-50 is not a promise that's out of line with most other countries. Actually, would say that by 2050 they could do something of that sort. There's a particular problem in New Zealand, and you're actually not comparing like with like. There's some funny business with carbon going in and out of forests that mean that,
the
50%.
Net, yeah.
That's right. The 50% is not quite what it seems. But I don't want to be critical, you know, too critical at what you promise in 2050. All these targets are provisional anyway, and the politicians that make them will be long gone by 2050. So let's judge people by what they do in the shorter term.
Yes.
But you do need a long-term strategy for radical cuts in emissions, I would say rather more than 50%.
How much are the people judging the government in the UK, for instance, by what it does? I mean, the UK is pretty highly evolved in terms of people who think about climate change. Mm. Most of Europe is, but the UK in particular, it seems. How much do they judge their government on what they do?
Well, I think they judge the government, make quite sophisticated judgments about how green the government really is. The new government we've had in Britain for a few months now made lots of green promises before it came in. It now seems to be tearing some of those up, which is causing some concern. But they will be judged on that. There's a constant debate about these issues going on in Britain. So they're not going to be able to hide what they're doing. And I understand they've got conflicting priorities. They've got a fuel levy, which will put up the price of petrol at the pump, and that's not very popular at the minute. So they're tearing that up. There are various other things that they're kind of short-term political measures that they're taking, which are bad for their green agenda. But they'll be called to account for that. I wouldn't say that's the top issue in Britain by any means, but it's a significant issue, and it does matter with quite a lot of voters. You know, we've been talking about climate change now for 20 years. Somebody pointed out the other day that it is 18 years since the British government first put adverts on the TV saying, cut your emissions and here's how to do it. So we've been talking about this for quite a long time.
This recession that most of the Western world is in, some more heavily than others, is clearly going to slow stuff down.
Mm.
And the danger is that we slip further behind the timetable to prevent more than a 2-degree increase by 2020 or thereabouts. If that recession persists, governments will become less and less inclined to put up money for subsidies for alteration of this or that, or to drive through legislation which requires people to actually pay more for
and they will be inclined. They will be inclined to think that because their emissions aren't going up, because the economy is not booming, that therefore, you know, they bought time. But it's not really like that, because your emissions may not be going up, but the gas is still accumulating in the atmosphere. There's an extra, you know, there's billions of tons more in the atmosphere every year, even if your actual annual emissions are not going up. So the political problem is that they may think they're buying time, but they're not. They're just sitting there while it gets worse.
Let's talk about water.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, When the Rivers Run Dry, you painted a picture of potential cataclysm. The world's water is being rapidly used up, far too rapidly for our own good. What is the international situation like now? Is action being taken in ways internationally and in various parts of the world where the water is short that give us hope?
Governments, or indeed anybody, tends not to act until they hit a real crisis. And in the case of water, that generally means literally when the rivers run dry. Some action is happening. I mean, I'm optimistic and pessimistic in rather the same way as I am about climate. I'm optimistic about climate because I know there are technical solutions there and they're perfectly doable. I'm pessimistic because our ability to do them seems to be rather poor. We can't get our act together, essentially. And it's rather similar with water. Most of our water is, especially in the drier parts of the world, is used for agricultural irrigation. That's the kind of pressure point on the system. We know how to irrigate crops using much, much less water, and it's not expensive to do it. It's just changing from just flooding the fields or spraying water into the air in the middle of the day when the sun's going to evaporate most of it. It's just about efficient use of water.
Is this
so we know what to do.
Dying hard, or is it an aversion to different switching to a different kind of technology, or what?
People kind of tend to stick with what they know until they literally run out of water, and then they think they should do something else. And there are other technologies like harvesting the rain that falls on your land. There are things that people will do, but they tend to only do it at the last moment when they should have been doing it 10, 20 years before.
Where are the real pressure points around the world now?
The places where rivers run dry. So if you go to northern China, northern China is getting drier because of climate change. It is also using all the water in the Yellow River in particular. It's the big river running through northern China. Northern China is a breadbasket for China. It produces most of its... Well, the rice is grown in the south, but all the wheat and so on is grown in the north. It's the breadbasket for the country. They're using literally all the water in that river. And they're scratching their heads thinking what to do. Well, what the first thing that they do is they stop taking water out of the river so much and they take more from underground. The underground reserves, but then you're overpumping the underground reserves. The water tables are going down and down and down by several meters a year. It gets more and more expensive to pump it out, and the water down there often is salty or otherwise not ideal. You really then reach a crunch point. China has currently got a plan to pump water from rivers, the Yangtze River in the south of the country, along canals more than 1,000 kilometers long to move that water into the north of the country. That is really expensive. And at that point, they think, well, maybe we should try some price incentives to get people to use less water. Mm. So that's what's happening in China. But there are many other rivers around the world that are running dry. The Indus, they had floods on the Indus in Pakistan a few months ago, but much of the time, it's a very flashy river, much of the time that river is running dry. No water reaches the Mediterranean Sea from the River Nile anymore, all taken by agriculture. You go to the Colorado or the Rio Grande in the U.S., similarly rivers running dry. People overpumping their underground water supplies to give them a bit more time, but that can't go on. Most of India is in a similar position. Mm.
What does that imply for world food supplies in the immediate future, medium-term future?
It makes them more dependent on the rains. It means that if you have a drought in one country, it can trigger global problems in world food supply, because food supply is a very international market now.
Yes.
Now, there are a number of reasons why there was that food price spike that we all heard about in 2008. It's another one being repeated now. The one in 2008 was caused by a number of things, but a bigger element of that was drought in Australia, which is a major exporter of grains around the world. A drought in one country produced a global crisis in prices of grain. And that's the world that we're facing now. Similarly, the drought and the forest fires in Russia a few months ago are probably the main reason why we've seen a new price spike now. So climate change, water shortages in one part of the world can now have a global effect on food prices that affect us all. That's the new world that we're in.
Will we see, as a response to that, assuming that the demand is going to remain, a decentralization of agricultural production and consumption, a return, if you like, to the old days? I mean, is that beginning to happen anywhere?
It may, because you begin to see countries banning exports. So Russia, after its fires, banned exports of grains because it said we need them for our home country. During the price spike in 2008, India banned export of rice. It was a major rice exporter. So the kind of protectionism that begins to take hold. So we may move back from a world in which global trade dominates. Let's see. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to be said for trade in food because it can make the system more flexible in many ways. But you can, especially if speculators get involved, and increasingly they are because of rising food prices, you can suddenly just fall off the cliff as regards food supply or food price at any rate. My own suspicion is that the global food trade, combined with less predictable climate, combined with rivers that we're using to their full extent, and water is the key factor in food production in many parts of the world now, put those together and we have a rather volatile food supply system where we're going to face more food price spikes, more food shortages, especially in parts of the world where people don't have the money to buy at those high prices. We've had it easy on world food supply. I mean, the world has done fantastic things on food supply. I remember when I was young and everybody said the world's population is going to double in 25, 30 years. How can we double world food production? Mm. Fact is, we did. Mm. And that was quite a considerable success for the world. So the massive famines that people used to predict for the 1980s and 1990s didn't happen. But there could be some more kind of turbulence along the track. We can't assume that we've solved the problem. Population still going up. We'll be at 7 billion this year. We'll probably reach 9 billion. We may peak at that point, but Malthus, these are big issues.
Malthus may return. There are cross-border issues with water too, which cause enormous concern. And you've written a little bit about the Middle East in particular, the Jordan River in particular. I mean, water is, and a lot of people say this, if this World War III is going to break out, it's going to break out over water. How much does the dispute over water, not just in the Jordan, but in the area there, add to the animosities and tensions and diminish the prospect for peace?
I think it adds to the problem. I think that's probably the right way of putting it. There are quite a lot of cross-border disputes over water issues. They don't generally lead to war or things kind of get resolved. But there are a number of rather nasty areas around the world. So, for instance, Israel's kind of close to monopoly use now of the River Jordan is depriving the country of Jordan of the water out of that river. Israel's domination of the underground water reserves on the West Bank is creating serious problems for the Palestinians. On the other side, the Israelis are rather efficient in the way they use water, so that at least they're making good use of what they have. But there are clear tensions there. Turkey, or the rivers that keep Iraq going, the Tigris and the Euphrates, all both come out of Turkey. Turkey is building a lot of huge dams, taking water out of those rivers. Huge source of tension there. And like many of these rivers, there are no international agreements on them. Long-running dispute about who has access to the water from the Nile. Most of it is currently taken by Egypt, but Egypt is downstream of a lot of other countries that want that water. How is that dispute going to be resolved? So there are a lot of these issues. There are potential flashpoints. My own judgment is that they won't often lead to war, and that when that happens, there will be other causes as well. But even so, if you have a potential flashpoint over, say, a large dam, and somebody bombs that dam in a war, you can have a lot of deaths, put it that way.
The geoengineering solutions rear their head again here. I mean, water harvesting, collection and harvesting now is almost gaining a certain respectability. I mean, and if it's done properly, it can work. Are there difficulties, though, with consentability, if you like, of projects? In this country, it's rather difficult. We're talking here now about water harvesting very seriously in New Zealand, and there are questions raised over how do you get a consent for this, given all the environmental implications. Is that being replicated around the world? Are countries tending to relax their environmental regulations in order to get a solution?
Most countries don't have environmental regulations that ban rainwater harvesting. These things tend to be done initially by communities or by individual farmers, just collecting the rains that fall on their land and channeling it somewhere and holding it in a reservoir or pouring it underground so that they can pump it up later. If you go to India, for instance, I mean, there are thousands, literally thousands of villages and communities doing that and keeping themselves on the road that way. That's fine. On a large scale, the guys who run the dams down in the river say, excuse me, the water that used to come down to our reservoir doesn't come down anymore because the farmers are all taking it upstream and they get cross. India at one point suggested that they might try and ban rainwater harvesting for precisely that reason. So when it happens on a large scale, there are issues about kind of water management, if you like, and what the appropriate way of managing that water is and who has access to that water. These things at the end of the day, when you only have so much water in a river, about who gets access. Should it always be the upstream guys who can get it first, or what about the rights of people downstream? So on a small scale, it looks like a good community project or a farmer's project to make good use of their water. And if they're stopping water from evaporating, then they're adding to the amount of water in the river system. But there are upstream, downstream, big consumer, small consumer disputes, and they'll need to be resolved through politics.
What role does the market have in the supply, reticulation of water?
I think it's going to have a role. We have to be careful here because we all need water every day. And if you're in Africa and you suddenly put a price on water and people can't afford it, then you can't have people who don't have access to water. So there has to be a human right to water. But when you're using water in large quantities for agriculture, I think there needs to be some pricing system. It's probably the best system that we know of for, if you like, making people use resources of any sort efficiently. If they have to pay for it, they think carefully about how they use it. Irrigators are going to think more carefully about how much water they use on their land, if they have to pay a sensible price for it, a realistic price for it. Mm. Right now, very few farmers around the world pay anything like a realistic price for their water. So I think pricing is going to be part of the solution. But we have to remember that there are human rights issues here. There are poverty issues here. Mm. If it's done properly, it's a tool for making people use water more efficiently. The Chinese are now beginning to adopt water pricing systems and raising the price of water very significantly for precisely that reason, because they know they're running real short.
Yes, but still protecting the small urban consumer.
Urban people can usually, at the end of the day, pay more for the water. It's the farmers who are the real big users and who need the water cheap, otherwise their crops become uneconomic. Yes. Really, urban and industrial users can always afford to pay more.
Mm.
Almost always.
Are we going to see large-scale desalination? Is that part of the future?
I think it's part of the future. More and more countries are doing it. You find Perth in Western Australia has been talking about doing desalination, Cape Town in South Africa, California, Florida.
Gulf States, yeah.
They're busy thinking about this. We even have one in London. We don't use it regularly, but it's there in case of a drought. So desalination, it's still quite expensive as a source of water, and it uses an awful lot of energy, mm-hmm. which creates climate change concerns, but it is there as an option. I think it's an option for cities of reasonable prosperity that need water. It is not really an option for farmers who need that water much more cheaply than desalination can deliver. Maybe a bit of horticulture somewhere, but in general. So the big users of water can't rely on desalination. The other thing is, if you're desalinating seawater, as soon as you start pumping it uphill away from the coast, it becomes even more expensive. Because water, as we all know, is heavy stuff. Pumping it around, pumping it uphill, adds to the cost very quickly.
That was British journalist and author Fred Pearce. He's been in New Zealand to attend the Climate Futures Conference organised by Victoria University's Climate Change Research Institute.